From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. First this morning, guest co-host Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with three-time NCAA champion and two-time Olympic runner Kara Goucher, who shares her book, The Longest Race, Inside the Secret World of Abuse, Doping, and Deception on Nike's elite running team. Then guest co-host Kate Rice and I speak with gastroenterologist Dr. Holly Clark from Intermountain Health Care, and she serves the Wasatch Back and joins to talk about the colorectal cancer public awareness campaign. It's called Let's Get to the Bottom of Colon Cancer, and she'll discuss the many reasons you should schedule your colonoscopy now. That's all coming up this hour. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our next guest is Olympian and NCAA champion runner Kara Goucher, who reveals her harrowing experience in one of the biggest scandals in the history of American running. It's all in the New York Times bestseller, The Longest Race, Inside the Secret World of Abuse, Doping, and Deception on Nike's elite running team, which ultimately ended the career of coach Alberto Salazar, perhaps the greatest track coach on earth, who was permanently banned from coaching in the U.S. in 2021 for doping, sexual, and emotional assault. Kara Goucher co-wrote this book with best-selling author and journalist Mary Pilon. Kara Goucher, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
There are so many layers in this book. It's almost hard to know where to start. But let's start with the maturation of your bio as a runner and how you came to the Oregon Project.
Yeah, I mean, I started running as a young kid and I started competitively running basically in middle school and ended up going to the University of Colorado on a small track and field scholarship, worked my way up to a full scholarship and won a few national titles. And after college, I was just really struggling. And so was my husband, who was also an NCAA champion, who's also an Olympian. And we just thought, you know, we're young, like what else is out there? Where else could we train? And so we visited a couple different coaches in the country and we were sort of recruited by the Nike Oregon Project. And so we went to visit and it was running professionalized. I think there's some professional teams now, but back then there really weren't professionalized teams. And it was an all men's team. So I was going to be the first woman on the team, but it was, running professionalized with a budget, with travel to go to altitude camps, with constant massage therapists, ART therapists, with rehab modalities, with all sorts of things that, you know, I had never had access to in my life.
Really a runner's dream. And you very much felt that way. Like, wow, how did I make it here? This is incredible. You felt so honored to be there. And then with the legendary coach, Alberto Salazar, when did it start to go wrong and what were the occurrences that surrounded that?
You know, there were little things here and there that early on were easy to excuse away. I mean, we had a teammate that we saw have some NCAA violations. But our coach, he just kind of excused it away. Just little things that, you know, made us uneasy, but nothing serious, nothing that we thought was like cheating or really crossing a big moral line. But I think that those little moments, you know, they set us up for some bigger moments to sort of excuse other things. You know, later on, you know, my coach, you know, the way he talked around me, the way he interacted with me was inappropriate. I started to see things that I felt like, not that I felt like I knew, were crossing ethical boundaries as far as anti-doping. And it was honestly, it was sort of a slow burn because I found myself, you know, we moved there in 2004 and it was in 2011 that I really was realizing, oh my gosh, I cannot be here another day. And so it took a lot of time to get to that point.
It really shows how complex that coaching and competitor relationship is. It seems like that's something that you need and you want, and it's part of your identity as a competitor, but that it gets kind of messy. Can you talk a little bit about how that works, how to get the best motivation from a coach without having those lines start to get crossed?
Yeah, I think, you know, I really have always been all in on my coaches. My father died when I was little. So, and my coaches have always been male. And so I think they have also sort of filled a role for me as someone that just to look to for guidance and someone who's guiding me through, you know, at that point, my dreams, towards my dreams of becoming an Olympian and being the best runner that I could be. I look back now and I realize that, you know, it was unhealthy the way I looked at Alberto and the way that I really opened him into my entire life, not just my running life. But you know, you're around each other all the time. You're around each other on a daily basis. You're traveling together. You're going to altitude camps together and living together. And really, this person is the controller of your dreams. You know, like this person is the person that's going to take you to what you've dreamt of since you were a child. And so I do believe you need like buy-in. You know, you have to really trust this person and believe that they're always going to put your best interest first, but it definitely can leave you a little bit vulnerable. And I think I had too much faith and too much trust, and it left me in a place where I was very vulnerable. Looking back, there were, you know, I've had two coaches since Alberto, and there were much more clear boundaries. You know, we just talk about running. We just focus on the goals. Of course, they want me to be happy as a human, but they're not asking me about my marriage or questioning my marriage or my choices in life. You know, those are things that really should be off the table for a coach. But at the time, I just trusted him with everything. And I felt like he was brought into my life for a reason. And so I definitely let him have too much power in my life.
Well, you started with him right after college, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's and when you're forming your life, it would make sense that, and with your background too, that maybe a father figure or authority figure came in and felt probably pretty welcome.
Yeah. And you know, like he would say that to me. He would say, I think God brought me into your life for a reason. I think God wanted me to be a father to you. And so that's where I'm most vulnerable. That's what I've always been missing in my life. And so I really thought, wow, I mean, I really won the lottery. Like this person not only can take me to my Olympic dreams, but he also is going to be in my life forever. And he cares about me as a human, and he's going to be there for the big moments. And, you know, looking back, it seems kind of silly. Like, what was I thinking? But in the moment, I really thought, like, this is what's supposed to be happening. Like, we were brought together for a reason.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with two-time Olympic runner Kara Goucher. She's written a new book, co-written a new book with journalist Mary Pilon called The Longest Race: Inside the Secret World of Abuse, Doping, and Deception on Nike's Elite Running Team. I think there was a moment that really jumped out at me. And I just want to say that we have all been in these situations where we feel like, you know, there's something wrong going on, yet we so respect and look up to this person that is committing this act that is wrong, that we feel like we can't say anything. And it's only afterwards that we go, why didn't I say anything? And that moment for me in your book was when you got into Alberto's BMW. He picked you up at the airport and you knew he was drunk, and your father was killed by a drunk driver. So there's a lot of sensitivity around that. And yet you didn't say anything. Can you talk about the moment afterwards in which you know, you sort of get to that point where you know that it's wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I knew he came to pick me up from the airport. I had an injury. And so I left my husband early over the holidays to get back to Portland to start getting treatment on my injury. And he came to pick me up from the airport to take me home. And it was just clear that he had been drinking. And, you know, I grew up from a young age knowing that you can never get in a car with someone who's been drinking, or you can never get behind the wheel when you've been drinking. And it's been something that I have been 1,000% true to myself to my entire life. And so here I am, and I know it's not right. And he took me to his house to get some treatment, and then he took me home and he drank while he was at his house as well. And my whole sense of self was like, it was almost like out of body. Like, I cannot get in this car. I cannot do this. But I just felt like I couldn't say anything. I was in fear that I would hurt him or disappoint him. And, you know, in the end, I just disappointed myself. You know, I got home and I just couldn't believe that I had allowed that to happen. And I felt like I lost a little bit of myself in that moment of not standing up for myself and not saying, no, I'm not getting in the car with you. I need you to call me a taxi. I was so disappointed in myself. And honestly, I was like more mad at myself. I mean, 100% more mad at myself than I was at him, because I felt like I really compromised myself as a person in that moment.
Yeah. Well, the story unfolds as a story of physical assault, a story of doping, a story of body shaming. And yet when you approached your co-writer, journalist Mary Pilon, she was reluctant to take this story. Now, she had written about Larry Nassar, the person who is now in prison for his sexual assault of young gymnasts. Why was she reluctant? And then why did she ultimately take the story and write this book with you?
You know, it's funny because I was talking to potential co-authors and she was the first person I felt truly connected to. She had written about the sport. She had written about me in the past. She had written about Olympic running. She had written about abuse in sport. And when I spoke to her, I thought, like, oh, she's the one, like, we are going to write this book. But I didn't realize that she had hesitations. You know, she was just taking the call to be polite. She had written about me in the past. She was just trying to be polite. But I think what changed her mind was that it was a multi-layered story. I had saved a lot of journals. I had, you know, what people call now receipts, you know, I had, and I told her she could have access to anything. She could have access to all of my blood work. She could have access to all of my journals. She could have access to all of my emails, anything she wanted. And I think for her, that was interesting. Like, it could be a little bit of an investigative piece, but also I think she thought, wow, this is so much more layered and nuanced than I thought. You know, I thought that it essentially was Alberto crossed the line in a doping sense. And we all know that. And he, you know, we know that he's been charged by USADA, but when we spoke, she realized there was so much more. And I told her about the sexual abuse, which I really hadn't told anyone aside from my family. And so, yeah, she ended up saying, like, as long as I have access to everything and everything is on the table, I'll do it. And I didn't realize that she had had hesitation until much later.
I was wondering, you mentioned in one spot that dissociation became your only safe space with some of the troubling things that had happened. And I know that you spoke a little about, well, quite a bit about body image and criticizing people's appearance and their weight and different things, not only yours, but some other women in the project. I think that is such an issue for so many women athletes. We're looked at as objects as well as performers and competitors. Is there anything that you could kind of suggest for young athletes or athletes of any age who are kind of finding themselves a little over-involved with their body image or having people over-involved with it?
Yeah, I mean, body image is a huge issue for women. It is a huge cultural issue in distance running because there's this myth that the thinner you are, the better you're going to run. And really, I was led into that myth as a youth. When I was in high school, that's when I first learned about eating disorders through running. And this isn't just a running problem. This is a woman problem, but it's really bad in running. And, you know, the times where I did develop some issues and restricted my eating, I had very short-term success. And then I had periods of years of being injured afterwards. And I think that's unfortunately what a lot of people experience. You know, you feel like you're doing everything right by trying to get as light as possible, but the damage you're doing, you don't see right away. It's later, it's your bone density, it's things breaking down. And so, you know, it's hard. I talk to high school girls a lot and I try to remind them that first of all, puberty is a good thing. You know, you don't want to stay tiny forever. A tiny little body is great and fun when you're little, but it can't handle the type of training and the things. It can't take you to the places athletically that you want to be later on in life. It just can't handle it. So, you know, puberty is tough and it's different, but once you adjust to that new body, you're incredibly strong and you can do things you never dreamt of before. But then also, like, if you don't fuel your body, you're not going to make it and you're going to be hurt and you're going to, you know, I feel like I stole 3 good years of competitive running from myself by trying to look a certain way. And the times in my career where I focused on being healthy and I focused on fueling myself and being good to myself and giving it what it needed, those are the years where I ran the best. And so It's hard because, especially with social media, you know, everybody looks a certain way, but the truth is there's no way to look as a woman or as a runner. There is no way to look. It's really about fueling yourself properly. I mean, everyone uses the car analogy because it's a good one. If you don't put gas in the tank, you break down. And we see it time and time again in running. And, you know, I feel like at least now we're finally talking about it a little bit more openly, that we have a really big problem in our sport. And, you know, the quickest way to a short-term career is to not fuel yourself properly.
Oh, that's excellent advice. I years ago, I read a book called Little Girls in Pretty Boxes about gymnasts and ice skaters. And they talked a lot about the puberty issue that, you know, these young girls start out when they're 8, 9 years old. And then when they're 13, 14, and their bodies are becoming what they're meant to become, they feel like they're failing themselves. And that, right. That need for performance and approval seems so strong. Like it's such a drive that it must be very, very difficult to navigate those waters.
It is difficult. And I think, you know, and gymnastics and skating are different sports. But, you know, I think we're seeing with Simone Biles, like it, you can be older and be really great. And in running, you know, women hit their peak in their mid 30s. I mean, we just had our Olympic marathon trials and we had so many moms and so many women in their mid to late 30s vying for a spot on the Olympic team. If you don't treat your body well in your teens and your 20s, you're never going to make it that far. And so it's really important. You're shorting your career before you've even hit your physical peak.
I love that idea that we're not hitting our physical peak till a little bit later.
Yeah.
Kara, shifting gears a little bit, you know, you went through years of having to recall and retell the stories of sexual assault by Alberto. And Mary Beth and I were talking before we started the interview about how, you know, we grew up in a generation where, you know, just blatant kind of, I don't know, sexual innuendo or, you know, you just accepted, you know, and even things like, you know, the men around town who go to kiss you on the cheek and then turn their face and kiss you on the lips, even that kind of thing that we've all sort of withstood over the years. And it's so hard to say where it starts and how to stop it in the beginning. And then, you know, how for you it developed over this time. I don't know. I don't know what the question is here really, but how did you withstand it? What were the instances in which that began to be something that you could no longer put up with?
You know, I think I was like a really good compartmentalizer. I think with my dad dying at an early age, I learned like, I don't want to talk about that. That makes me upset. It also makes other people uncomfortable when it comes up. So I'm just going to put that in a box and put it to the side. And I had a stepfather who had a really bad temper. And so I learned to like, put aside like his anger, it doesn't help me. And so I did that with athletics as well. You know, like I'm feeling pain in a workout. I can't accept that pain because I need to push through. So I'm going to put it over here. So I think that served me as an athlete, but as a human, it ended up really hurting me because when these things happened, instead of accepting that they were happening, I just kind of put them in a box and put them aside. Like this doesn't actually help me get to where I'm trying to get. So I'm going to put it to the side. So there was a lot of undoing that had to be done in this whole process of really going back. And, you know, it's interesting hearing you say like, oh, like the comments and someone just kissing you on, you know, like that kind of stuff happened at the Oregon Project, like not necessarily kissing, but like a lot of sexual talk, a lot of talk, and especially being the only female, it happened all the time. And at times, like, I'm not happy with how I acted. It got to the point where I would tell my own jokes just to fit in, to move on. Because if I acted offended, then it was like, I was a prude and I was the one that was, you know, not fun. And, you know, I think the first time that Alberto touched me inappropriately, I could not accept that it was real because then everything I've built my belief system on over the last couple of years is a lie. You know, then first of all, like, Where would I tell? Where would I go? I mean, everyone involved is male, you know, everybody, all the way up the chain. I mean, there's a building of him on the Nike campus. But then even just really personally, I've put my entire faith and trust in this person. And I believe that this person has been brought into my life for a reason. And so if this is true, then I'm an idiot and everything I believe is wrong, you know? So I think women, we really learn how to just like make up stories to make it not be true. And in our head are justifying things and just excusing behaviors. And, you know, it really was therapy and years of having to talk about it to sort of undo it, because yeah, I just had built up these storylines in my head that I had just accepted as truth so that I didn't have to deal with what was really happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is going to be a strange question, but was there ever a part of you that felt some sort of sympathy for Alberto because of the world in which he was raised and his come from, and not possibly realizing that these things were assault and that they were wrong and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, like we were very close, and he told me about his childhood and his complication, you know, his parents' complicated marriage. And, you know, like, again, I think it's part of your excuse. It's like, well, he grew up in, you know, his parents had a troubled marriage and his dad was a certain way and that's what he saw. And this is the, you know, I mean, you just sort of like make up these things, and that doesn't necessarily mean that that hasn't influenced him, but you know, it also doesn't take away his onus in what happened. Right. And so, yeah, I think that was definitely part of my compartmentalization of it was like, well, he's a good guy. Not everyone's perfect. He didn't grow up in a perfect situation either. You know, he's very macho. Those things happen, you know, and of course now looking back all these years later, it's like, no, there was a very clear line that was crossed. But in the moment, you know, I think as women, or anyone that's in this type of abuse, you're surviving. And part of that survival is just making up whatever you have to make up to make sure that you get through it and you can move on from it. And in the immediate, that's easier than dealing with the fact that, oh my gosh, my coach just assaulted me. It's easier to make up all these stories, but later in life, it caught up with me.
Well, it's also, I think athletes, like you mentioned, are great at compartmentalizing and telling yourself this is about resilience, this is about determination and discipline, and it was tied up in your income. I mean, this is your livelihood. And that was one of the things I appreciated so much about the book, was that you give hard numbers, and so many young athletes go into a field, but they really don't know what's out there for them. If this is a viable way to make a living, if this is something, like you also mentioned how your time of making a living can be somewhat short. So you have to be smart about it. So would you talk a little bit about that, about how that income and being paid was part of that picture?
Yeah. So I, at the time, was sponsored by Nike and I had a contract. And so my contract had a yearly salary, but it had requirements. So I had to race a certain amount of times. There were certain things I had to do every year. Like during an Olympic year, I had to make the Olympic team or be ranked top five in the world, things like that, do appearances. And I was making a good living, but I also, there were consequences to it at times. Like I couldn't let so much time lapse between competitions. And sometimes I would get a really serious injury. And so I would run before I was fully healed because I couldn't risk, you know, getting reduced, you know, it'd be like a permanent 25 or 35% reduction on my salary for the life of the contract. So it caused me to make some poor choices as far as my health is concerned. But, you know, I was in a situation in which I had a Nike contract and I had a Nike coach and I was living and training on the Nike campus. And so I'm really, really embedded in Nike. And so
incestuous.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, at the time it felt like I'm living the life, right? Like I know everyone at Nike. I can talk to Mark Parker. That's who was the CEO at the time. I know everybody and everybody knows me. I'm crushing it. But in reality, when I started to see things that I wasn't no longer comfortable with, I realized I really had nowhere to go. I mean, my coach had a Nike building. My coach was Phil Knight's right-hand man. I mean, who am I going to talk to and say, I don't think he's appropriate. I don't think he should be coaching people. I know in this situation, I'm the one that's disposable, right? It's me versus
that's a tough one.
Right. So what am I really going to do? And so I couldn't even think that way until until I just couldn't anymore. And even when I made the decision that I cannot be here another moment, I still wouldn't tell anyone why I was leaving. I just said, even when I met with Alberto, I just said, I'm not progressing. I'm injured a lot. My life is different. I don't think your coaching works for me anymore. I couldn't say, you know, you touched me inappropriately. You tried to kiss me on a plane. You've crossed anti-doping lines. Like, I can't say that because I'm still a Nike athlete, right? I know they're going to find a way to get rid of me if I say this stuff out loud. So it was a really difficult situation. And also my entire life was Nike, all of my friends, everyone I associated with. So, you know, when I finally did leave the brand, not just Alberto, it was so hard because not only did I lose, you know, the brand and everything, but I lost all my friends, and it was really difficult.
Quickly, this is the 60th anniversary of Title IX, and so many people it became possible for women to take part. Is there maybe anything that you could encourage our young women athletes that you wish someone had told you early on?
That you have a voice and use it. You know, don't just be so grateful to be here. You know, Title IX was put in there because we deserve to be here. We deserve to have equal opportunity. I feel like we still have this little feeling of we're just lucky to be here. That's definitely how I felt throughout my career. You know, the Oregon Project was a men's team. I'm lucky to be here. I'm the only woman on the team. You deserve to be there. The legislation was passed because we have equal rights to men in this area. I mean, like in any opportunity, it wasn't just for sports, Title IX. Obviously, sports was a huge impact for a lot of women in it, but you know, I think we are seeing some shifts. I think we've seen it in women's basketball. Just a few years ago, they weren't even allowed to say March Madness in their marketing. And now more women are watching Caitlin Clark and women's basketball than men's basketball. And that's we deserve to have the same coverage, opportunities, everything. So the one thing I would just say is don't feel like I'm just so grateful to be here. You can feel grateful because, of course, you're living your dream and you're having, you know, opportunities that you've dreamt of, but you deserve to be there, and don't put up with something that you know is wrong because you just feel lucky to be there.
The book is The Longest Race: Inside the Secret World of Abuse, Doping, and Deception on Nike's Elite Running Team. Our guest is Kara Goucher. Kara, thank you so much for writing this book. And also, I just want to mention there is something in this book for everyone, whether it's men, women, young athletes, whether you're a runner or have never run down the road. This is a really important book. So thank you very much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Kate Rice.
Intermountain Health is doubling its efforts in a unique community colorectal cancer public awareness campaign. It's called Let's Get to the Bottom of Colon Cancer. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths. And joining us now to tell us more is gastroenterologist Dr. Holly Clark. She'll talk to us about colon cancer, screening, and other related GI issues. Dr. Holly Clark, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Recently, and maybe in the last couple of years, as far as I know, we've gone from wanting to screen by doing colonoscopy from ages 50 up to ages 45 up?
45. Yeah. So a couple of years back, the screening age was changed from 50 to 45. And that change was made in response to the observation that over the last two decades, we have been finding colon cancer and colon polyps, precancerous colon polyps, in younger and younger individuals. Some startling statistics. If a person was born in 1990, their risk of developing colorectal cancer during their lifetimes is twice that of a person born in 1950. And we're trying to figure out why that is. Looking at that another way, 12% of new colon cancer diagnoses last year were in patients under age 50. So a very striking thing to have observed over the past couple decades. And for that reason, we have started screening everyone at age 45. And there is talk that over the next decade, that screening age might actually be reduced to 40.
We never know, you know, any health issue is that is on the rise in an inexplicable way. We have to look at environment and lifestyle and diet. What are we doing differently now? I mean, as someone who deals with a whole host of GI related issues, what's going on in our gut that's different than it used to
be? Well, Lynn, I think that you know this probably better than anyone. I know that you have an interest in health and prevention. And you know what young people are eating these days? I have a college age daughter. I know what she eats, and it's not good. A lot of processed food, fast food, you know, anything fast and convenient, fewer fresh fruits and vegetables, fewer fresh foods in general. People ask me that all the time after I diagnosed polyps or, you know, heaven forbid, cancer. You know, how could this happen to me? Why did this happen to me? I'm vegan. I do yoga every day. Like, how did this happen? You know, so there we talk about, maybe I'm getting a bit off topic here, but we talk about modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. So, you know, for sure, you can do everything right. You know, the vegan yoga instructor and, you know, trying to eat a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables and avoiding meat and processed foods, which, you know, we can get into more of those recommendations later. But then there are non-modifiable risk factors. You know, unfortunately, we can't change our genes. And if somebody inherits a gene from Uncle so-and-so that put them at risk for colon polyps or colon cancer, well, we can't change that. Definitely lifestyle and our environment and the increased ingestion of processed, unfresh foods and fewer fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables.
So Holly, I was sort of curious about, you talk about the importance of stress management and how emotional distress can make us more vulnerable to disease. Can you talk a little bit about that as just a preventive practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of getting off the top of colon cancer specifically, you know, I don't have any, you know, hard evidence that proves that stressed out people get more colon cancer. But, you know, I think it's common sense, right? It's all connected, you know, mind, body, GI tract, our microbiota. I mean, it's all connected. And in my practice, once again, getting off the topic of colon cancer, that discussion comes up daily, multiple times per day, usually in the context of IBS symptoms, constipation, gas, bloating, abdominal pain. I mean, there's a huge, huge, huge mind-body and more specifically mind-gut connection. The two are very closely linked. And I'm sure that carries over to colon cancer and these other diseases of the gastrointestinal tract. We just have much better evidence for that sort of thing when it comes to speaking about irritable bowel and these other disorders that maybe we can focus on another day. It's fascinating.
I get the sense that our gastrointestinal systems might be sort of the forgotten stepchild because who wants to talk about going to the bathroom?
Yeah.
And why is this an important system for us to pay attention to? Because it sounds as though even though it is a disease that has the second highest death rate of all cancers, it also sounds as though practicing prevention, like with colonoscopies, also makes it one of the more preventable ones as well. So why is the gastrointestinal system so important? Do we tend to sort of ignore it because just it's not polite? It isn't like polite conversation. Maybe start with that.
Yeah. Well, you know, along those lines, nobody likes to talk about it. I mean, every day, several times a day, I hear from patients, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm telling you this. Like, and so I think a big part of my job is really trying to make people feel comfortable talking about these things, you know, like, oh, come on. I know it's difficult for you, but I talk about this all day, every day, and have been for the last couple decades. And so, you know, I hope that I and my partners in gastroenterology can do a better job going forward or do a good job making people feel comfortable about talking about these topics. And, you know, colon cancer screening, yeah, it's not a sexy topic. I mean, just the thought of colonoscopy, I think, is absolutely horrific to many. But, you know, we talk people through it, and I think a lot of people come in for colonoscopy and think it's going to be this quote embarrassing experience where, you know, they're exposed and under bright lights. And sorry, Lynn, I'm getting a little graphic here, but it is what it is. And, you know, I just tell people that this is important. You've got to do it. We can prevent colon cancer by doing a colonoscopy and removing precancerous colon polyps. That's point number one. Point number two, you know, everyone has a colon, everyone has a backside. And point number three is that during a colonoscopy, you know, you're covered up with a blanket the whole time. You know, it's very professional. We're looking inside your colon for colon polyps, and that embarrassing stuff, it's not even an issue. It's not even an issue.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with gastroenterologist Dr. Holly Clark. She's talking to us about Intermountain Health's campaign to bring more awareness around colorectal cancer. And the campaign is called Let's Get to the Bottom of Colon Cancer. And Holly, you are on the Wasatch back 100% of the time. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in, you know, Park City and the Heber Valley, and then the rest of your team?
So there's a team of four of us, and we are equally divided. Well, yes, for the most part, equally divided, spending our time at both Heber Valley Hospital and Park City Hospital. Yes, we're on the Wasatch back, but it is, our catchment area is amazing. I mean, we get patients from Rock Spring and Evanston, Wyoming. And especially in Heber, we see a lot of patients from the Roosevelt, Duchesne, Vernal area. And actually, a lot of patients come up from Salt Lake City to see our team in Park City and Heber. As I mentioned earlier, I practiced previously in Salt Lake. And so I'm honored and flattered that a lot of my patients from the Valley come up as well.
That's a great sign of a great doctor. Well, since we were talking about conversations around the GI tract, I have to relate this kind of funny story. I was on a girls' weekend last month, and we started talking about colonoscopies and things like that. And the story somehow evolved into Elvis Presley, and that he actually died from complications related to constipation. And of course, then I got obsessed with it, and I started looking it up. And, you know, apparently, largely, he was so embarrassed by his condition and had this poor lifestyle and poor dietary choices. It was so preventable. And I don't know, I just thought I would bring that to light, because we need to talk about this stuff, and we need to not be embarrassed about it. Wow, what can happen to your colon when you ignore it like that?
Once again, coming back to diet, I see a lot of people in clinic who really don't realize how terrible their diet is. You know, we always talk about fiber, fiber, fiber. We should all be ingesting 25 to 35 grams of fiber per day, which is difficult, if not impossible, to tally up every day. You know, I think the message is more plants, less meat. Meat doesn't have fiber. Dairy doesn't have fiber. Cheese doesn't have fiber. Oils don't have fiber. Fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains all have fiber. And fiber is obviously, you know, the cornerstone to treating constipation. But what a lot of people don't realize, people are always asking me about, you know, should I take probiotics? You know, what about my microbiome? And my message to people is, sure, you can, but the single most important thing you can do to maintain a healthy gut microbiome is to eat a wide variety of fresh fruits and vegetables. Why? Because the good bacteria in our gut feeds on natural plant fiber and generates a lot of we as humans can't break down fiber effectively. So we count on our gut bacteria to do that for us. And in doing so, those gut bacteria generate a lot of potent anti-inflammatory substances. I won't get into too much detail here, but short chain fatty acids that have all sorts of anti-inflammatory, immune boosting properties. So, you know, fiber, yeah, it can help you avoid constipation and help you avoid poor Elvis Presley's fate, but it also has so many other benefits. And, you know, sure, you can buy probiotics. That I don't think they're going to hurt you, but, you know, even more important, eat natural foods, fresh fruits and vegetables. That's the best thing you can do.
Well, I have to say, you're singing my song in a couple of different ways. And one is just keep it simple and eat more fruits and vegetables. But I wanted to circle back a little bit when we were talking about colonoscopies in the early age, that now they recommend starting it. But also, how often are you supposed to get them?
Good question. So in an average risk individual, meaning no family history of colon cancer or precancerous polyps in a first degree relative, meaning mother, father, brother, sister. So if you don't have such a family history in a first degree relative and your colonoscopy is normal, meaning no polyps, then you don't have to come back for 10 years. Then if you have a family history of colon cancer in a first degree relative, once again, meaning mother, father, brother, sister, or heaven forbid a child, then you come back every 5 years. And then if you have precancerous polyps found and removed during your colonoscopy, that surveillance interval will change to usually 3 to 5 years, depending on how many polyps, how big are they, and what type of polyp does your biopsy report.
Now, the other thing you said that I really loved hearing was anti-inflammatory and immune system boosting. And it sounds as though this is like maybe the specialty of our gastrointestinal system in keeping us healthy. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the role that it plays in our bodies overall and why it's so important to pay attention to these bodily functions besides looking at Elvis Presley's fate, which I think is a great cautionary tale.
Yeah. Well, we're really at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to understanding our gut microbiome. You know, people will come into clinic and bring these tests that you can get them all over the place now that kind of break down their particular microbiome and tell me how much of this bacteria and that bacteria. And my answer to them, they're like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, I was told I should take such and so supplement for this result. And my answer to that is we truly are at the tip of the iceberg with that knowledge. Like it's rapidly developing and we're learning more and more every year, but we're not really sure what to do with that information yet. And, you know, the benefit of taking probiotic X versus probiotic Y. But what you alluded to earlier, I mean, let's keep it simple and use common sense. And like I mentioned earlier, maintaining a healthy gut microbiome is imperative for preventing cancer, for preventing heart disease, for preventing all inflammation all throughout the body. And it just comes back to diet, you know, the quality of the food that we are putting into our mouth. I mean, it affects every other system in our body. And it's also going to affect how you feel physically from day to day.
So Dr. Clark, you know, I had a colonoscopy last May or something. And when I called to make it, I think it was in make the appointment, it was in the previous November or October. So it took me 8 months to get in. I know that in part, this is because now they're screening people beginning at age 45. It would seem that you are a very busy person, as is the rest of your team. Why is it taking so long to get in for just your regular screening colonoscopy?
Well, it was formerly, and I'm sorry that you had that experience, but that was the norm a year ago. I think that was in part due to, number one, we were understaffed on the Wasatch VAC, and number two, a huge COVID backlog. You know, our screening program, as everything else, was on hold for a period of time. And so then there was a big backlog of people waiting to have colonoscopies. But I am very pleased to report that that has changed. You can get a colonoscopy next week. I mean, really, you know, we have openings on our schedule now, you know, this month. You will not be waiting 6 to 8 months for a colonoscopy. So yeah, Call over to the hospital. We can get you in.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking mostly about colorectal cancer here today and the awareness campaign by Intermountain, but you have this whole host of other issues that we treat that, or that you treat, that we won't really be able to get into today. But I'm just wondering, you know, when you see someone with issues in their colon, could it mean that, you know, they've had something else that went untreated for a long time, like IBS or, I don't know, any of these other things that you look at? It's also interesting to me.
You know, the topic of IBS, I mean, that is so, so common. You know, in a given clinic day, if I see 15 patients, 13 of them might end up having some variation of IBS. I mean, it's just rampant. It's so common. And yeah, I mean, I could do another show with you just about IBS alone. I mean, it's just so common. And fortunately, I mean, linking IBS back to colon cancer, IBS doesn't cause colon cancer as far as we know. So many people are very relieved to hear that. But, you know, back to diet, does diet put you at risk for developing IBS? Of course. Does uncontrolled stress or past emotional trauma put you at risk for developing IBS? I mean, everything I'm saying right now applies not only to IBS, but to, you know, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, yeah, you name it. Yeah, so a lot of people ask me about the stool in a box test, or my primary care doctor wants to test my stool for microscopic blood. You know, can I just do that instead of a colonoscopy? And my answer is always, any screening is better than no screening, for sure, hands down. So if you refuse to have a colonoscopy for whatever reason, but you'll do the stool in a box test, then by all means, yes, definitely do it. But an important point that I like to make is that there is a huge difference between detecting colon cancer and preventing colon cancer. So the stool tests do a pretty darn good job at detecting colon cancer. But as I tell my patients, who wants to know if they have colon cancer? You want to prevent colon cancer, right? And so those other tests can detect colon cancer, but colonoscopy is the only test that can prevent the development of colon cancer down the road, because during a colonoscopy, precancerous polyps are detected and removed, thus preventing the development of cancer down the road. So that is a very common question that I get on a daily basis, and a point that I wanted to make during Colon Cancer Prevention Month.
Well, that sounds huge to me. I mean, and that sounds to me like the big selling point for getting a colonoscopy is it's all about prevention. And I just think that is so, so important for everyone to remember, especially when we're a little hesitant. But you've just talked about how, first of all, it's really easy to get in now to make an appointment and have a colonoscopy pretty quickly. And the benefit of it is it means you can just prevent so much. Now, I had one other question. It seems to me that the whole thing with a colonoscopy is more the prep period. And it also seems to me it's not as unpleasant as it used to be, as though the prep period is just like the biggest deal. And you've actually made it a little less onerous.
Yeah, I think so. It has improved over the past, you know, decade or so. But as I tell my patients, you know, it's still not pleasant. Sorry, there's no getting around it. There's no way we can purge your entire colon of all stool and have that be and do it over a 12-24 hour period and have that be a pleasant process, right? I mean, people will ask me, well, can I just like do a juice cleanse or go get colonics? And it's like, no, I'm sorry. There's no way around the prep. Like you would think that those sort of things would be sufficient, but they're not. There's like, you know, even in people who have come in for a colonoscopy because they have chronic diarrhea, I mean, even in them, there's like residue coating the wall of the colon. It's so important to have a pristine colon prep and adhere to that preparation process, because if you don't, if your prep is suboptimal, small flat polyps can be missed during your colonoscopy. So yes, the prep has improved, but Kate, I would be telling you a fib if I told you it was pleasant. It's better, but you know, it's, you know, it's just something you got to do. And yes, most of us use a prep now that, you know, it's a powder that you buy over the counter and you mix it in the beverage of your choice. So if you like to drink smart water or whatever, any clear liquid, you know, mix it in that and you can't taste the powder. And so at least it's more palatable. Now you're still spending a lot of time on the toilet. No getting around that.
Well, I always just make sure that I have a really good treat waiting for me on the other side.
There you go. Yeah.
And that always helps.
That's important.
What got you into this specialty in the first place?
I'm asked that frequently. And usually my first answer is, it makes you wonder about me, doesn't it? But I mean, the truth of the matter is, it's a very complicated answer for me specifically. But, you know, before we go into gastroenterology, we have to complete an internal medicine residency. I don't know. I realized during my gastroenterology rotation, during my internal medicine residency, that these gastroenterologists were doing something amazing, preventing colon cancer. I mean, that, you know, that's just such a fulfilling part of my job. And also I realized early on that it was unique to be a female in this field. And so, a minority of gastroenterologists are female these days. In fact, right now, I think I might be the only Intermountain employed female gastroenterologist in the state, but nevertheless, it has been a very fulfilling career choice for that reason as well, just because over the years, the majority of my patients have been female. I think females feel more comfortable with females for this particular procedure and maybe for talking about things like bloating and constipation and fecal incontinence. And so, you know, it's been rewarding just to help people to prevent colon cancer and to help women, and just to, you know, really kind of focus on women's female gastrointestinal health.
That's a great answer. And Holly, before we let you go, and I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I just wanted to ask quickly about going back to the stool in a box test. Is it reasonable to think, I mean, to me, having a colonoscopy once every 10 years, like in that time, cancer could develop. I mean, we get mammograms once a year, right? Mm-hmm, and sure. So is it reasonable to say, I'm going to get my colonoscopy, and then if I'm worried about it, every year I can do a stool in the box test, and at least I know I'm sort of good.
Yeah, I don't think your health insurance will cover it more frequently than every 3 years. But keep in mind, if a positive result occurs along the way, then you'll be getting a colonoscopy, which is fine because we want to prevent colon cancer. But I just think it's important to keep in mind that a positive result on those stool-based DNA tests, or even if your primary care provider is just testing your stool for microscopic blood, a positive result would, of course, be followed by a colonoscopy. And that positive result may be indicative of something serious, but it might be indicative of an internal hemorrhoid, you know, so just realize that the positive result is followed by a colonoscopy then.
Dr. Holly Clark is a gastroenterologist with Intermountain Health, serving patients along the Wasatch Back, both in Park City and the Heber Valley. And we're so happy, Dr. Clark, that you could join us today on The Mountain Life. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was fun. I appreciate it.
And thanks to Dr. Holly Clark, again, of Intermountain Healthcare. She serves patients in Park City and the Heber Valley. And thanks also to our first guest, Kara Goucher. She's a three-time NCAA champion runner and two-time Olympian, and she tells her story in her new book, The Longest Race, really compelling story. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.